Hello, I'm Bill Sisson, Executive Director of WBCSD North America. Welcome to another edition of Transformative Leadership in Business. I'm joined today by Ralph Danola. He's the CEO of the New Buildings Institute, also known as NBI, and a lead fellow. Ralph, thank you for joining me today.
It's a pleasure, Bill. Thank you for having me.
We really want to spend some time today talking about this organization, NBI. It's been around for 25 years, as I understand it, and its role is really to be a trusted and independent resource for the building sector that are creating outcomes that are better for people and the environment. Kind of did a little bit of reading ahead and found your vision is to transform the built environment that can be carbon-free, sustainable, energy efficient, and supports thriving economies that benefit all people and the planet. Amazing. So, Ralph, I guess it's really by no accident that you have a bit of background in preservation. I found that you had a little stint at the National Park Service at one point in your life, and then did some incredibly leading work on historic preservation projects. So with all that kind of in your DNA, tell me a little bit about your leadership journey, being both now a CEO and a lead fellow at NBI, and what you might call the transformative leadership role that you play.
So maybe a little bit of background on NBI, and then I can talk a little bit about my background. It's important maybe for your listeners to know that New Buildings Institute has been around for 25 years. We just celebrated our 25th anniversary last year. And so we've actually been reflecting a lot on that and thinking about the next 25 years. So we are, I think, at this kind of inflection point, both in terms of the organization and the industry. When NBI was founded back in 1997, the premise behind the organization was that there were several industry leaders, the founders of this organization and the original board members, founded the organization out of frustration with the lack of advancement of national model energy codes and the desire to really have buildings perform better and really focusing on high-performance buildings. At one iteration, it was kind of considered to be the New Codes Institute. But since that time, the organization has really expanded both in terms of our vision and mission, but also in terms of the work that we do in the building sector. So we're really very much focused at this time on decarbonization of the built environment and really doing this with a focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion and thinking of advancing energy codes, which we continue to do, but also a very strong interest in technology and research and design guidance, supporting the building industry and building industry professionals. So that leads us to the three program areas of this organization. The first one is called Getting to Zero Leadership and Market Development, really convening the industry leadership. We have our annual conference coming up in a couple of weeks, the Getting to Zero Forum, and we will also be convening our Next Gen Fellows. That's a scholarship program for college and university students working to bringing the next generation of leadership into the industry. Our Building Innovation Program, basically, again, where we do research, we develop design guidance, and we have a couple of initiatives there that we focus on. The Grid Optimal Buildings Initiative, really focused on getting more recognition and market transformation around building grid integration. And the Advanced Water Heating Initiative, a focus on market transformation of water heating and working to get heat pump water heaters to be the dominant technology by 2030. And then our Advancing Codes and Policy Program, where we do that codes work. And we work on national model codes, including the IECC and ASHRAE 90.1, and also with states and cities working to advance both base codes and reach and stretch codes. Anyway, that's background on the organization. We have a team of staff really all over the country. I believe we're in 10 states, and a really passionate and committed team of professionals that are dedicated to transforming the building sector. I did get an undergraduate degree in historic preservation. The first jobs that I had out of undergrad was actually working for an architect that was basically doing historic preservation work. And that's when I did some work for the National Park Service and wound up actually getting a job there. It was a wonderful position where the title is exhibit specialist, which the exhibits are buildings. So we work to both stabilize and restore historic buildings in the Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area, which is a large recreation area between New Jersey and Pennsylvania. moving on from there, I actually went to grad school at University of Oregon, got my master's degree in architecture. And from there, I worked at a firm, Sarah Architects, a prominent firm in Portland, Oregon, that both works on historic preservation, but also at the time, green building. And that's where I really started with the LEED pilot version back, I think, in 1998 or 99, and really grew up with LEED in my practice. And then I joined Green Building Services as a consultant and ultimately became a principal there. And that was my last position before joining NBI back in 2013. So it's been about a decade here at NBI, and this organization has gone through a lot of transformation itself and remains on the leading edge in this building sector or built environment transformation that we're seeking.
That's great, Ralph. And, you know, you brought up your sort of early stints in the historic preservation world in the Delaware Water Gap. And only for you and me, but maybe the listeners would enjoy knowing, I spent my sixth grade summer retreat in the Delaware Water Gap. So sort of probably stayed in one of the buildings that you historically preserved, you know, at one right. point in my life. So amazing. But no, look, we're no strangers. You and I've known each other for a while, and I've seen you in action, and you really do strive. You're passionate about building bridges and tearing down walls so that knowledge sharing and collaborative environments are truly created. Whether you do this at the forum or through this collective action group on the Net Zero Collaborative, that's what I really value in your style and your approach to solving this really complicated problem. So thank you for that intro. Now I want to kind of flip it to a bit of a conversation on this world of net zero we're living in. Everybody's net zero everything these days. And in fact, a lot of companies that are part of our membership have truly established a robust, scientifically backed plans to get them to net zero. But what I often don't hear of is how the buildings and real estate factor into that. So why is there no net zero without decarbonizing this sector?
Net zero is easy to say, and it's hard to do. And what we've been trying to do is to provide the resources, the tools, and the guidance for people working in the building sector to make this a success. Going back, I believe, about 12, 13 years now, we set up our Getting to Zero Buildings database. So we're tracking the buildings across the country that are either verified as zero energy or are pursuing it. And those buildings, far and away, the vast majority of them, and I think we have about 760 buildings in that database at the moment. It's free, accessible to the public. The vast majority of them are all electric. And as you suggest, the focus on decarbonization. So the direct combustion of fossil fuels really in buildings accounts for about half of total energy consumption in the United States. That's a significant amount of carbon emissions coming directly from buildings. And that contributes potentially both to indoor air quality and local air quality concerns. And we think about cities that might have difficulty attaining clean air requirements. And so, yes, I think getting to zero implies also decarbonizing buildings themselves or electrifying, as we also know that concept. You know, there's four major pieces of equipment in buildings that are using fossil fuels. There's heating, there's water heating. So space heating, water heating, cooking, and clothes drying are kind of those major end uses. We've actually developed some research on that, the Building Electrification Technology Roadmap, looking at those end uses, what's the state of technology development in those four categories, and really providing guidance. And I would say one of the things that I'm very focused on right now, and as you're suggesting, we need to make this transformation. And in the realm of like, how are we going to get this done? I think the bipartisan infrastructure law, the Inflation Reduction Act, is going to go a long way to spurring the market and market development. There's going to be some private capital that's going to come into that. We're going to see a lot of leveraging. We're going to see a lot of leading by example. So the federal government now has a federal building performance standard. States and cities are adopting building performance standards. That's the regulation around the operation, either energy or carbon, of existing buildings. And that federal building performance standard basically is asking for a elimination of scope one emissions, which is the direct combustion of fossil fuel in buildings. I think we're going to see those avenues. And I know one of the challenges that we face is having the workforce to get the work done. And I'm talking about across the whole supply chain, from resourcing the materials, manufacturing, distribution, installation, and then the professional services that support this as well, architects, engineers, contractors, facility managers, having the skill set So like you're saying, the companies that are your members, the leadership at the top is saying, yes, we're going to do this. We have science-based targets. We're going to be moving forward. We have ESG. But what we often see is a disconnect between that leadership and the boots on the ground. We can work with the leadership. We could work with the design professionals. We can work with the boots on the ground to get this work done. But the question I always have, you know, when I talk with folks, for instance, in the federal government or the ones that are responsible for public buildings, tomorrow there's going to be a water heater that fails. So are you going to replace it with a gas water heater? Are you going to replace it with an electric resistance water heater? Have you thought about what it would take to get a heat pump water heater in there? It really comes down to that, right? Like, we have to start today. The thing that is probably the biggest challenge is what we call business as usual. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, and I was actually just speaking at the IFMA Facility Fusion Conference in San Francisco. And what you hear from facility managers is, this is a mandate and we don't have the funding, the time, the resources, right? And so, however, we also found that a number of people in our audience basically had ESG in their job description. So as a facility manager, they are required to basically report into ESG reporting. So that's a positive sign. I think we're at this inflection point where the requirements are coming from leadership. We all know we need to do this, right? Like, it's clear the climate crisis and all of the natural disasters we see, like, I think now everyone's understanding there's something really significant playing out. The question is, what is my job day to day as a building industry professional? And how am I going to do this myself? We all have to basically come together and say, where are the gaps? What are the barriers? As you said, like, where are the walls? And how do we break them down? And from my perspective, and I think I believe very strongly in conscious leadership, I believe very strongly in empathy and compassion. I really think that we need to play to people's strengths. I think that we need to support people in professional development and give them kind of the pathway and the resources. I think there's been a huge shift in leadership today. And what leadership is today is basically supporting the success of your team, your staff, your clients, your customers, your membership. It's in service to. And we all need that perspective because that's how we're going to get it done.
Let me draw this back to NBI for all the reasons you're talking about, which is creating that environment for, as you call it, leadership and market development to take root. So you have made a tremendous impact, directly or indirectly, on the adoption of these codes and standards that are driving efficiency into the marketplace. I love the Next Gen Fellows platform, which is, I won't say future proofing because we haven't fixed the problem today, but at least creating the skill sets we'll need going into that place you talked about, where we have a robust marketplace of capacity and capability to support this transformation. And then the innovations around how things are going to have to change, you know, the decisions around my water heater breaking and knowing the only option is to go all electric with efficiency of a heat pump. Those are mindset changes that it's going to take organizations like yours to stand up. Let me flip a bit to the impact of the built environment on energy efficiency has actually taken root. It's safe to say that we build a much more efficient product today. New buildings and even retrofits, frankly, are benefiting from things we can do to make buildings more efficient. But at the same time, we're building kind of like the equivalent of a Paris every 5 days. So we're locking in a lot of bad choices, even within the good choices that are being made. One of those areas that we're just starting to talk about is the role that embodied carbon is playing in this sort of net zero space. Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about where you're seeing that at NBI, and is it starting to enter into the conversation in meaningful ways?
Buildings have a very significant impact on this whole question about carbon or greenhouse gas emissions. We know that. We know there are about 37% of the total carbon emissions in the U.S. And globally, embodied carbon is like 11% of emissions. And what's interesting is new construction is critical. Like, we really need to focus on existing buildings. But every new building we build, we know will be around for 50, 75, 100 years or more. Even the ones that are supposedly temporary stick around for a lot longer. So it is important to get it right. And I think the thing is, we feel very strongly confident that we know how to do new buildings right. It's not a blank slate, but you do get to design from the outset. And one of the things that we know from our database is we know that we can get a zero energy building in every building type, in every climate zone. We have evidence because there are real buildings that exist. Amory Lovins always loved to say, that which exists is possible. So we know it's possible. The question is every new building pursuing zero energy from out of the gates? No, it's not the case yet. The good news is new construction codes are ratcheting down to zero. So just last February, the committee committed to getting ASHRAE 90.1, which is the regulation of most commercial buildings in new construction in the US, down to zero by 2031. That's a fantastic goal. It's in the next couple of cycles. Similarly, we're seeing the IECC also ratcheting down. And so I think we're seeing the national model codes moving in that direction. And we're actually seeing states and cities adopting those requirements earlier. You know, NBI actually now a couple of years ago put out these building decarbonization code overlays. And those basically said, here's how you close the gap on these model codes. And so we're actually seeing jurisdictions take those up, and that will help to take care of the new construction question. Now, how many jurisdictions in the US? What about elsewhere in the globe? We know the global south is going to see most of the development in the future. NBI has always focused on the US and some work in Canada, but this question about should the work that we do expand to other parts of the world? We actually have been engaged in India with our Grid Optimal Buildings Initiative to support utilities in India as they try and grapple with energy delivery in certain cities. We have this potential of expanding beyond the US borders and taking these resources that we have and sharing them with other parts of the world.
This sort of goes back to how I described you as a transformational leader. It's creating those environments, doesn't matter if they're in the US, creating those environments in which knowledge can be shared and enabling collaborations can result in true systemic change. And I think the experience that the US has in some ways is very much a leadership experience in and of its own in trying to drive and shape this transformation agenda through the codes and standards work that I know you've been a part of.
I didn't directly address this question about embodied carbon. So the work that we're doing now, because we have done this work on what I would classify as operating energy national model codes. And now what we're working on is a focus on getting embodied carbon into building codes. So yes, that other pretty significant percentage of emissions. And what we're seeing is pretty phenomenal because the approach that we've taken with industry leadership and partners in collaboration and with some of the leading manufacturers is to look at material by material approach. So starting with concrete, looking at steel, looking at glazing systems. And what's exciting is the innovation that's happening in those places. Concrete is the leading carbon source in embodied carbon in the building sector. But now, in some cases, no additional cost, you can get a much lower carbon intensity concrete by choosing a certain mix design. That's huge progress. And so these industries are committed also to getting to zero. And I think we're seeing that in these different segments of the supply chain for the building sector. There's a long way to go. But again, with the power of the federal government and Buy Clean movement, I think we're going to see really rapid transformation in this industrial process arena.
Let's draw that out to something we talked about earlier, which is the demand side of this transformation, the pull for these types of advancements, because at the end of the day, it's kind of that characteristic request that's going to make the decision making happen up and down the supply chain much more efficient. There's got to be ROI here. There's got to be future-proofing your assets. There's got to be elements of this discussion you can build into a conversation with an investor of these properties or an occupier. What do you tell someone with respect to why this is an economically good decision?
I think it was like in 2010, I put this presentation together and I had this one slide with big red letters, obsolescence. The reality is there's this concern about buildings being obsolete. And I think that institutional investors are beginning to really ask these questions. This is where ESG is really going to have some strength. And we all know that ESG at the moment doesn't have a lot of clear and concrete standards or requirements in the real estate sector, but there's a lot of leadership between ULI, WBCSD, NAREIT, and others who are developing resources for the real estate sector or in ESG. But the thing is, institutional investors have an incredible amount of power. And if they have ESG goals, and if they have real estate in their portfolio, or if they are specifically focused on investing in real estate, they can drive this transformation. So there's this kind of a little bit of two ends against the middle, because if you have real estate assets in a jurisdiction that is adopting building performance standards, you really, really must understand what the implications are and how you transform buildings to comply with building performance standards. We want to make sure new construction codes will lead to the construction of buildings that meet building performance standards when they're operating. And then I think we want to have building performance standards really regulate the operating energy performance of those buildings. It's a little bit like guiding the building sector toward these goals like the Paris Agreement or the 1.5 degrees and saying, if the building sector is responsible for 37% of CO2 emissions or 11% of embodied carbon emissions, how do we drive that along a path to achieve these goals in the timeframe that has been basically adopted by the US and 200 other governments around the globe? The real opportunity here is to say we can directly connect the outcome of building performance standards to goals like 1.5 degrees, because you can do it on science-based analysis. So that's where we're headed. And I think it's exciting because those goals from leadership need to come down to the folks that are operating these buildings and making choices about replacing equipment and improving the building envelope. I think it's finally coming to the fore.
Back to our favorite phrase, business as usual, I would say business as usual is obsolete by its very nature, as the world is quickly moving to this all-in transformation from the basic entry of an architectural design to how an investor needs assurances that what comes out of the pipe is an actual net zero measured, truly documented outcome. So I think we'll be here before we know it. Give us some insights as to how equity, decarbonization, the built environment transformation we're going through, how equity is really starting to shape into that overall agenda.
Yes, low income and hard to reach disadvantaged communities need to basically be put front and center in all of this work that we're doing, because if we move forward with decarbonizing the building sector and we don't work to support those communities first, they are going to be left holding the bag, paying really high costs for utilities and what might be increasing costs for utilities. And that energy burden is really what we're focused on. So energy burden, basically the fact that low income and disadvantaged communities often pay a much more significant amount of their income to energy costs through utility bills, that means they are not able to afford other things in their lives. So given that we know how to make buildings more efficient, we can weatherize multifamily buildings, we can weatherize single family homes, we could at the same time work on decarbonization by electrifying end uses, get in there and replace a furnace with a heat pump, a water heater with a heat pump, et cetera. And we can improve the comfort and indoor environmental quality for those families and communities as well. Wanting to make sure that the people that can least afford this transformation are supported. And we see this actually in things like the Inflation Reduction Act, where they've specific income requirements for some of those incentives. And that's going to go a long way to supporting that transformation through a more equity-centered approach. So I've had conversations with folks at Emerald Cities Collaborative, and they've been very focused on a more equity-centered approach to workforce development. And what they're working on is trying to build generational wealth for people that work in the trades that are actually going to be the workforce that will help to actually achieve this decarbonization effort. Can contractors stand up businesses and get a pipeline of work and then have, you know, generations in their family actually be successful in business? That requires some support, but it certainly can help with building equity into our communities and lifting people out of a low income scenario to be really successful professionals in the workforce.
You go back to the point I made earlier, we are a constructive breed. right? We build stuff, and buildings today and in our future, you know, we're building the equivalent of a Paris every 5 days. Those are good jobs, and they're fundamentally changing in terms of technical capacity and in some cases even quality, where these are going to become essential, if not critical, jobs for the future. So why not take that all-in approach? Everybody's on an equal playing field, and let's build the capacity we need to make this transformation. I think that's very admirable, and I'm really glad to see you're bringing that into the built environment conversation. So Ralph, thank you so much.
Thanks, really appreciate your time.